From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Flu season is coming. Should you get a flu shot? On today's Fresh Air, some information to help you make up your mind. We'll talk with Robin Marantz-Hennig, author of a book on viruses called The Dancing Matrix. And we'll hear from Dr. Paul Gleason, epidemiologist for the Influenza Research Center at Baylor College of Medicine. Also today, betrayal, loyalty, and the dilemmas of gay men. We talk with novelist David Levitt about his new novel, set in the 30s, in which he finds parallels to gay life in the 90s. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Back to Broadway, Barbra Streisand's new album of show tunes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Arson investigators in Southern California say there was another small suspicious fire in the Hollywood Hills today. That fire was quickly put out, largely because the winds were light and didn't drive it into a firestorm like the blaze that struck Malibu. Firefighters say the Malibu fire is now 70% contained, although the main body of the fire has burned well back into the Santa Monica Mountains. More than 200 houses have been destroyed or damaged by the fire. One man has died of wounds he received while trying to rescue his cat. Officials say the fire was almost certainly caused by arson, and a privately raised reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of the arsonist has now grown to $250,000. There were a series of attacks on Turkish businesses and homes around Europe today. Kurdish rebels are suspected of carrying out the attacks. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The firebomb attacks were carried out in London, Zurich, and at least nine German cities, including Berlin and Frankfurt. One man was killed in an arson attack in Wiesbaden. The attacks were aimed at Turkish banks, airline offices, and embassies. A similar set of incidents took place in June. Responsibility for the violence then was claimed by the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. Although there was no immediate claim of responsibility for today's violence, German officials said they assumed it was also the work of the PKK. Over 10,000 people have died in the Kurdish region of Turkey since the PKK began its drive to create a separate state in 1984. In recent months, the organization has tried to draw international attention to the situation, not just by arson attacks such as today's, but by kidnapping foreign tourists in the region. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
More than three dozen Haitians are undergoing deportation proceedings after they were smuggled into Miami last night. NPR's Derek Reveron reports.
According to the Immigration and Naturalization Service, smugglers dropped off 37 Haitians in the waters near Miami Beach and then fled. This is the second time within the last 2 weeks that Haitians have turned up on South Florida shores. Recently, smugglers left 40 refugees on Miami Beach. Both groups of Haitians came from the Bahamas. The U.S. embargo against Haiti has made it difficult for refugees sailing from that country to reach America. This latest group of Haitians includes 24 adults and 13 children. They're being held in Chrome Detention Center for refugees and may eventually be paroled to live with family and friends. Within months, however, they'll have to appear in federal immigration court to face deportation hearings. I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 37 points to close at 3,624. This is NPR. A measure designed to extend federal unemployment benefits for 1 million Americans remained stalled today on Capitol Hill. The measure would provide up to 13 weeks of extra coverage for people who've used up the standard 26 weeks of benefits without finding new jobs. The delay was caused by a dispute over how to pay for the program, which is expected to cost $1.1 billion. House and Senate leaders are still trying to work out differences in their respective versions of the legislation, but Congress won't be able to vote on the benefits until at least next week. That would amount to a 6-week delay for the program. Federal investigators continue to search for clues for what caused two buildings to collapse at a construction site in Chicago. Two men were killed and five others injured. Melba Gomez of member station WBEZ reports from Chicago.
Investigators from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration are walking through the twisted steel frame of the city's new main post office building, trying to determine why a beam buckled yesterday, causing workers at the site to fall 2 and 3 stories. 2 workers were killed, 5 others were hurt. Agency inspectors say it's too early to pin the collapse on safety violations. They do say subcontractors have been cited 4 times this year for violations at the site, and speculation is centering on how the beams were welded. Ironworkers, meanwhile, are refusing to return to the site until a cause of yesterday's collapse is determined and the area is declared safe. For National Public Radio, I'm Melba Gomez in Chicago.
A group that favors abortion rights released a study today indicating that violence and threats of violence are common at clinics where abortions are performed. The Fund for the Feminist Majority said that more than half the clinics it surveyed reported severe anti-abortion violence in the first 7 months of this year. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're entering flu season, and most of us at Fresh Air can't make up our minds about whether to get a flu shot. We figure a lot of our listeners are facing the same dilemma, so we decided to get some information that could help us decide. Joining us first is Robin Morantz Hennig, a medical writer whose latest book is about viruses. It's called A Dancing Matrix. Let's start with the basics, like what is influenza?
Influenza is a viral infection that causes respiratory symptoms. It causes a lot of symptoms that are similar to a cold. It makes you cough, and it might make your nose run. But then it goes way beyond it. It leads to fever and muscle aches and just an all-over sense of feeling horrible. It's not what a lot of people call the flu, which is a stomach infection. There are no gastrointestinal symptoms to influenza, you know, what should be called the flu. It's a very easy virus to spread. It can live for a long time in the air, so that if you touch a surface that somebody has sneezed on a couple of hours ago, you can infect yourself. So even being in a crowded elevator or a room with a sick person makes you very likely, like 50% likelihood of getting infected as well.
Now, this year we're being warned about the Beijing flu. What is the big deal about the Beijing flu?
It seems to be an especially virulent strain of the Beijing flu. It seems to be causing more symptoms, more severe symptoms and lasting longer than earlier strains of the flu. It's called Beijing because that was the first place that it was noticed. I guess it was, I forget what year, 1992, I believe. Flu viruses are named according to where they were first discovered. And very often they're found in Asia. The thinking is that it's because in Asia there are so many people living in proximity to so many farm animals that they actually mix up their flu viruses, and so that a human influenza virus will pick up a little piece of a pig influenza virus or a duck influenza virus and change enough to be a new virus that gets a new name.
When you have the flu, how do you know if you're still contagious? Or, to put it another way, when your friend or colleague has the flu, how do you know if they're still contagious?
Well, unfortunately, you start being contagious before you know you have the flu. A day or so before you actually come down with symptoms is when you start being contagious. And then for the first couple of days when you have symptoms, you're still highly contagious. So the people who, drag themselves into work, no matter how bad they feel, are doing nobody a favor.
Now, once you've been home a few days, say your fever's over and you're going back to work, but you're still sneezing or coughing, do your sneeze and coughs still spread germs?
They don't have as many flu viruses in them because your body's antibody response has already come into play. You probably can still spread some germs, but it's much less infectious than it was a few days earlier.
So don't be a hero if you're getting the flu.
Right.
Stay
right.
Home. 2 people can be in the same room with a third person who has the flu, and one of those 2 people will get the flu and the other one won't. Is it just a question of how strong your immune system is?
I think it's less a matter of your inner resources with influenza than it is with some other conditions. I mean, everybody knows that when you feel especially run down, you are likely to get a cold or you're likely to get I don't know, stomach flu, you know, what we call the flu. But influenza seems to be pretty highly likely to infect people no matter what their underlying health is. So it's unclear why one person will actually get sick and the other person won't. It could be just a matter of what previous flu strains he's been exposed to. And if it's been a strain that's close enough to the strain that's going around now, his antibodies will fight it off effectively. And if it's not been a strain that's that close, his antibodies won't.
Robin Moranz-Hennig is the author of A Dancing Matrix, Voyages Along the Viral Frontier. She'll be back with us a little later, and we'll find out if she's decided to get a flu shot. Our next guest has already gotten his. Dr. Paul Gleason is the epidemiologist for the Influenza Research Center at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. He says it's important for people in the high-risk group to get vaccinated. We asked him who falls into the high-risk category.
People 65 years of age or older, and people with any sort of chronic heart or lung conditions. And the lung conditions include asthma. After those conditions come people with other chronic illnesses, whether it be kidney disease or anything that suppresses their immune response, or chronic anemias like sickle cell anemia or anything like that. Next come people who are household contacts of those high-risk persons. So anyone who has, say, an elderly grandparent in the home, or who has a brother who has asthma, for instance, they should also take the flu vaccine, because if they take the flu vaccine, then hopefully that diminishes their chance of getting infection, and then they will be less likely to expose the high-risk person.
So now I understand some people are in the high-risk groups, and these are the people for whom the vaccine is most recommended. Now, do you think that other people, if they have access to the vaccine, should get it?
Yes, I think that if they want to reduce their risk of having flu and its complications, why they should take it. The only people for whom the vaccine is contraindicated are people who are allergic to eggs, because the vaccine is grown in embryonated eggs, and if a person really has an allergy to eggs, then they shouldn't take the vaccine.
You know, I think a lot of people have a fear nowadays of putting a dead virus in their bodies through a vaccine. And maybe it's a rational fear, maybe it's an irrational fear, but there is this feeling that what if we find out 3 years from now that there was something wrong with a vaccine? I think people are very worried about that. Is that an irrational fear?
Well, I think it is, yes, because, as I said, the vaccine is purified by several processes to eliminate, you know, any of the host proteins and other materials, so that it's very pure. And I think that when you consider the alternative, which is having a natural infection, which is very destructive to the epithelium of the respiratory tract, that taking the vaccine is a pretty minor affair.
Now, what about our memories of, I think it was 1976, when some people got a disorder called Guillain-Barré syndrome,
right,
which left them temporarily paralyzed. Now, granted, this happened in very few cases, but it did happen, and that left a lot of people with a permanent fear of the flu vaccine.
Right. I can understand their apprehension, because I think that instance has been studied very well, at least epidemiologically, so that we know that there was about a risk of 1 in 100,000 persons who received the swine flu vaccine to develop Guillain-Barré syndrome. Now, let me just say parenthetically, it's important to remember that if you give vaccine to 30 million people over a period of about 2 months, you have to remember that, coincidentally, a certain number of people will come down with Guillain-Barré syndrome. In other words, there is an expected rate of Guillain-Barré that will occur within 30 days after vaccination. So what we're talking about is...
You mean coincidentally?
Coincidentally, yeah. That has nothing... It's just a temporal association. Has nothing to do with the vaccine at all.
What are the short-term effects of the flu vaccine, and what's the likelihood that you'll have short-term side effects?
Well, first thing, of course, is soreness to touch at the site of injection. So almost everybody gets some slight discomfort at the site of injection. Now, occasionally, and maybe about 5% of people, they'll get a little bigger reaction, so they'll have maybe a little redness and swelling at the site of injection, but that usually is gone within 3 days. Another 3 to 5% may feel a little achy or have a headache or feel a little weak the following day and maybe the second day. And again, those symptoms can be reduced just with aspirin or acetaminophen. So those are fairly simple and controllable side reactions. Now, one of the things that occurs, though, during this time of the year, as soon as children go back to school, there's a mixing of respiratory viruses in the community, and we have a big increase in colds, you know, throughout the community, and this occurs every place. So again, coincidentally, people develop colds, you know, in the week or so after they've had their flu shot, but the shot doesn't cause that.
Yeah, I know several people who say that they would never take a flu shot again because the 1 year they got it, they shortly thereafter ended up with the worst flu they've ever had.
Yeah, right, right. Now, the other thing that occurs...
So you think that's coincidence when that happens?
Yeah, well, there is a circumstance where they might really have gotten the flu, and that would be the circumstance where they wait until flu is already in their community. It's already epidemic in the community. And then they say, oh, gosh, I got to go and get my flu shot. So they go down to their doctor and get a flu shot, and then 3 days later they come down with the flu. Well, the thing that they have to realize is that protection doesn't start immediately, that it takes at least 2 weeks for them to mount a good immune response, at least 2 weeks, to the vaccine. So that if they wait until flu is already in the community and they get exposed, then they may go ahead and get the flu despite the fact that they had the vaccine, you know, within a week.
Mm-hmm. What about people with HIV? If people are HIV positive, should they get a flu shot because their immune systems are endangered, or is that a reason not to get the flu shot because, you know, they're being injected with a virus?
Well, they are definitely recommended to have the flu shot. Now, if they just have HIV infection and don't have AIDS, they will respond just as any person their age would respond to the vaccine and make good antibodies. If they do have AIDS and are in the immunosuppressed phase of the disease, then their response to the vaccine will not be optimal, but they still will respond, and they're recommended to have it. Now, the good news is, though, that much to our surprise, people with AIDS do not appear to be particularly vulnerable to influenza like they are to some other virus infections.
Dr. Paul Gleason is the epidemiologist for the Influenza Research Center at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. More on the flu after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in again with medical writer Robin Morantz-Hennig. Her latest book is all about viruses and viral research, so we wanted to know if she was going to get a flu shot.
No, I'm not, and my kids aren't getting a flu shot either. It seemed to me when I weighed the pros and cons of getting vaccinated that it really wasn't worth the uncertainty about whether the vaccine would even work and the limited value. You know, if I got a flu shot this year and it kept me from getting sick this year, I would have to get it again next year because the immunity doesn't last for very long.
Now, what is the uncertainty you're referring to about whether the vaccine will work?
Well, the flu virus changes a great deal from 1 year to the next. And so when scientists are coming up with what they're going to put in this year's vaccine formulation, they have to make basically an educated guess based on what they think this year's flu virus is going to look like. That means they have to look around the world and see what is out there infecting people 6 to 8 months before it comes to this country. Our flu season is usually the winter, running from about December to March. But they have to start making a vaccine beginning the previous spring. So it's only apparently about a 50-50 chance that they've even made that guess correctly, that they even have put into the vaccine the kind of flu strain that is going to start infecting us. Then once they give you that vaccine, it's only up to about 70 or 80% likely that you're going to develop the antibody response that will keep you from getting sick. In other words, you could be getting a vaccination and get sick anyway. Then the biggest reason to get a vaccination is if you're in one of the high-risk groups that the CDC talks about. You know, if you're over 65, if you've got chronic infections, if you've got a problem with immunity already. If you're basically young or youngish, as in my case, and basically healthy, the flu isn't going to do much more than sort of lay you up for a week or two. And it's better for you to get the natural infection and develop your own natural immunity.
Well, what's the difference between your natural immunity that you would develop if you got the flu and the immunity that you would develop if you got the vaccine?
Well, they're similar. It's an antibody response. Your body builds up antibodies that are designed to fight off the flu virus that it's been exposed to. But for some reason that they don't really understand yet, the antibody response is less vigorous when it's in response to a vaccination. The flu vaccine uses what's called a killed virus. It's pieces of the flu virus, but it's not really a live virus. This is to make it safer, but it also makes the immune response less hardy. So the antibodies that are created for some reason disappear after about 9 months or a year, and you have to get vaccinated again. When you've got exposure to a normal, full, live flu virus, the antibodies that you create are maybe more plentiful. I'm not quite sure of what it is about it that makes it more robust, but they last for basically your whole life.
Oh, for your whole life. But
they last for your whole life against that very strain of flu.
But what are the odds are that you'll see that strain of flu again?
Well, it's virtually nil because as part of its strategy of survival, the flu virus mutates and changes slightly from one year to another, and you basically never see the exact same strain a second time.
So what good are those antibodies going to do you?
Well, you see usually the changes are relatively minor, and so if you see a very close relative of that exact same strain again, the antibodies that you've got will keep you from getting very sick. That's why the big fear is that the flu virus will change in a major way, will do something called an antigenic shift so that it's totally unrecognizable to anybody because nobody has seen anything like it before. And none of the antibodies that anybody has developed will provide any kind of even limited protection. That's when you get what's called a pandemic flu, like the one in 1918 that killed so many people.
Now, lots of people have what might be an irrational worry, but lots of people have it, that they don't want to put any kind of virus, even a dead virus, into their bloodstream, and that enough things have gone wrong in the history of modern medicine. You know, they're concerned maybe we'll find out, in 2 months or 2 years or 10 years that there was something not quite right about the supply of vaccine. Is that irrational?
A lot of people might be remembering stuff like the swine flu vaccine campaign. You remember that from 1976?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Actually, that was the first and last time that I got a flu vaccine. I bought into all of that, partly because my boss let me take my lunch hour to go do it. It just seemed like the patriotic thing to do at the time. But it turned out not only did we not have a major epidemic of swine flu, but there were many cases, about 1,000 cases of Guillain-Barré syndrome, a side effect of getting vaccinated with a virus, in this case a flu virus, but it's happened with other vaccinations as well. Now, when people are looking at it in retrospect, they realize that the large number of Guillain-Barré syndrome cases came about because there was a large number of vaccinations during that episode. But that is still a risk, a slight risk, but a risk for people who get flu vaccine.
Now, if you were in a high-risk group, would you think twice about getting a vaccine?
No, I'd get it right away. My parents are both over 65, and my father has kidney disease, and I've encouraged them for years to get a flu vaccine, and they do. And that's part of the reason that, I guess, you know, as sort of a public-spirited thing, I don't rush out to get one because I know that the doses need to be available for the people in high-risk groups who really do need it. Unfortunately, a very small percentage of those people, I think I've heard like 20% or so, actually get vaccinated. And those are the people for whom this public health message really needs to go out, that they do need the vaccine because influenza, common as it is not a harmless illness. It causes up to 20,000 deaths or so a year, even in an ordinary year when it's not an especially virulent kind of strain going around. And this year, people are worried that it might be an especially harsh strain of influenza.
How does flu lead to death? What are the deaths caused by?
I guess it sort of weakens the respiratory system to begin with. It's a respiratory infection that goes to the lungs and nasal passages and throat and sort of sets you up for secondary infections, either bacterial or viral. So most of the deaths are caused by these secondary infections like pneumonia. Most of them, like 90% of them, are in older people. That's why they're considered the high-risk group.
You live in one of the neighborhoods where they're giving flu vaccines in grocery stores or supermarkets. What do you think of the idea?
Well, if it were an unmitigated good, if everybody knew that what they really needed was to get a flu vaccine, then it would be great because it's very convenient. The cost is pretty low. I think it's about $15 at my neighborhood Giant, and you can, you know, do it all at once. You buy your lamb chops and you get your flu vaccine. The problem is that when they advertise it, they don't make any kind of designation of who should and who shouldn't get it. I don't know how much information they give at the site. And the only way that they limit it is they don't give it to children, at least in the Washington, D.C. area. Anybody else who feels a need for it can just roll up his sleeve and get it.
Would there be any reason to think that you would be better off getting the vaccine from your doctor than at some kind of public setting? Is it all the same serum?
Yeah, I think that the formulation is the same no matter who gives it to you, and I don't think that, you know, paying $50 for it makes it any better than paying that $15 for it. I just would like to make sure that in a more public setting there's still enough education. People know what side effects to look for and know what the possible hazards are and whether it's something that's worthwhile.
Well, I wish you a healthy winter.
You too, Terry.
Thank you very much. Robin Moranz-Hannig is the author of the book A Dancing Matrix, Voyages Along the Viral Frontier. Earlier, we heard from epidemiologist Dr. Paul Gleason. Well, I hope you have a healthy winter. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, novelist David Levitt talks with us about his new novel, While England Sleeps. It's about a love affair between two British men from different social classes. And classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews Barbra Streisand's new album of show tunes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A senior member of the U.S. Senate has accused some officials in the CIA of trying to manipulate American policy toward Haiti by leaking damaging information about exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Massachusetts Democrat John Kerry serves on the Senate Intelligence Committee, which has oversight responsibility for the CIA, and today he sounded an alarm.
There is no doubt that individuals within that agency are engaging in a separate foreign policy track, and that they have sought to place certain information in certain hands in an effort to run a course counter to the policy of this country.
The CIA has reportedly prepared a personality profile of Aristide, which questions his mental stability. It's been leaked to the press. Asked about the profile, Secretary of State Warren Christopher said today he has the full range of information about Aristide and believes the Haitian leader is worthy of U.S. support. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The White House has abandoned plans for an announcement this week or next week on the nomination of John Payton to be Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, the job for which Lonnie Guinier had been considered. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports that Payton is a highly regarded Washington attorney with long experience in private practice and public service. But in a meeting with the Congressional Black Caucus, his answers failed to satisfy and even raised concern about his commitment to enforcement of the Voting Rights Act.
According to sources who were at the meeting, caucus members were alarmed and outraged when they learned that the prospective nominee to head the Civil Rights Division had a long history of not voting, and Payton conceded under a barrage of questions that he has no experience in the area of voting rights enforcement and knows little about it. At least a half dozen members of the Black Caucus could well lose their seats as a result of voting rights litigation stemming from a Supreme Court decision last year, and many members of the caucus risked their lives to win passage of the Voting Rights Act. This is a matter of life and death to us, said one member, but he acknowledged the Clinton administration has no backup nominee. The fracas over the nomination means that even if Payton is eventually named, the Clinton administration will have been in office more than a year before it succeeds in putting in place a new civil rights chief at the Justice Department. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
The government says the number of people filing first-time claims for jobless benefits moved down in the latest reporting period. The Labor Department says in the week ending October 30th, new claims dropped by 10,000 to 338,000. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 37 points to close at 3,624. This is NPR News. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says that a new Russian military doctrine does not mean a return to a time of nuclear threats and Soviet expansion. Earlier this week, Moscow dropped its promise not to start a nuclear war and defended its use of Russian troops to deal with unrest in different parts of the former Soviet Union. The secretary told Congress today that the new Russian military plan also contains an important element that Russian military missions will only take place with other former Soviet states, and where fighting is already underway. Budget Director Leon Panetta told a congressional committee today that under President Clinton's health care reform plan, 30% of Americans would pay more for health insurance. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports.
Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala created a controversy last week when she told Congress that 40% of Americans would pay more if the president's health plan is adopted. That prompted White House officials to recalculate their estimate, this time comparing not only what people pay now for insurance premiums, but also what people pay in deductibles and copayments. As a result, the administration came up with a lower estimate. 30% of Americans, they say, would pay more for health policies, an average of $24 more a month. White House officials estimate that the vast majority of Americans would pay a lot less, about $64 less a month. And without any reform at all, Budget Director Leon Panetta said, every single American will pay more, a lot more, because he said that's how fast health costs are rising. I'm Patricia Naiman reporting.
The government says that factory orders were up in September for the second month in a row. The Commerce Department says that shipments of finished products in September increased to record highs. Officials say that factory orders were up by 0.7%. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. After writing about gay life in contemporary America, David Levitt has looked to the past for his new novel, While England Sleeps. Levitt is the author of The Lost Language of Cranes and Equal Affections. His first collection of stories, Family Dancing, was published when he was 23 and was nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award and National Book Critics Circle Award. His new novel is about love and betrayal, art and politics, and is set in Europe in the 1930s. An upper-class young writer named Brian falls in love with a ticket taker in the London Underground named Edward. When Brian has an affair with a woman, Edward, heartbroken, runs away to join the Loyalists in the Spanish Civil War. Levitt says his book is inspired in part by the British poet Stephen Spender's memoir. Spender has actually sued Levitt in England for breaching copyright and for breaking a British law that protects authors from having their work altered. Levitt declined to comment on the suit. I told him I was surprised that he set his novel during the Spanish Civil War. In the past, he'd been criticized by some for not writing about larger political and social issues and for being too insular and suburban. Is his new novel a response to those criticisms?
You know, I would like to think not. I would like to think that I don't choose to write about anything in response to criticisms. Who can know, ultimately? I do know that I reached a point where it seemed to me impossible to continue as a writer without contending on some level with politics. And I was thinking initially of trying to write about the politics of the 80s, the politics of the world I was living in at the time I began this novel, as well as the time I finished the novel. And the reason that I was drawn to the Spanish Civil War and to that period was because I saw so many parallels between the 30s and the 80s. And it seemed to me to provide an opportunity, as it were, to write about what I would call the AIDS wars without writing about them, to create a kind of historical allegory for the period we're living in now.
What were the parallels that you saw?
Well, primarily the fact that specifically in this novel, this is the story of one man trying to save another man's life, one gay man trying to save his lover's life. And certainly the period we live in now is full of stories like that. It's also about the clash between a feeling of loyalty to a cause or a country on the one hand, and a sense of deserving a degree of personal fulfillment which that cause or country or institution deems immoral or deems wrong on some level. Forster wrote in his essay, What I Believe, he said, if I had to choose between betraying my country and betraying my friend, I should hope I should have the guts to betray my country. And really, I think the dilemma that this novel presents is the dilemma of a gay man for whom that choice isn't merely hypothetical. It's very, very literal. It's very visceral. And I think now, as well, gay men are constantly finding themselves in a position of having to make a similar choice.
You wrote your new novel, While England Sleeps, during the debate on gays in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if writing about the Spanish Civil War, writing about the military back in the 30s, affected your take on the gays in the military debate, or if, in fact, the debate affected the issues that you put in your book.
It did and it didn't. It's a peculiar parallel because, in this case, what the novel's about is someone trying to get out of the military, whereas the debate about gays in the military is about the rights of gay people to be in the military. One parallel that I do see, and that I thought about a lot while I was writing the book, was the fact that there is a real disparity in people's attitudes toward, on the one hand, gay behavior, that is, sex between members of the same sex, and on the other hand, homosexual identity. There's a curious paradox there, and it's a paradox that's always existed both here and in England. The problem in the military never seemed to be the fact that gay men and lesbians in the military were having sex with each other or with members of the same sex. That's been going on forever, and I think it's always been implicitly accepted as long as it wasn't talked about. The crisis began when gay men and lesbians in the military demanded that their identity be acknowledged and accepted. And that curious distinction between behavior and identity is one that all gay men and lesbians have to deal with, and it's an interesting conflict. It's also one that comes up in the novel, particularly in the scenes where Brian is trying to convince John Northrop, the head of the English Brigade, to let Edward go, and it becomes clearer and clearer that Northrop's conception of their relationship is that of a sort of sexual exploitation, that is, the upper-class man exploiting the lower-class man. He can't conceive of the relationship as one that has emotional or that has an emotional basis or that is based on love. He assumes that it's purely about sex. I think a lot of people assume that gay relationships are purely about sex because they're unable to make the cognitive leap from the idea of homosexual behavior to the idea of homosexual identity. And that, to me, is a theme that I've been dealing with in my work since the very beginning. I am always asking the question, to what extent does what we do determine who we are?
My guest is David Levitt, author of the new novel, While England Sleeps. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Novelist David Levitt is my guest. Do you think of yourself as being active in the gay rights movement? I remember in an article from several years ago, you were talking about how when you were younger and you needed a job, you went to a gay bookstore, you know, and asked about work. And the owner of the store was asking you about your movement experience.
My movement experience.
Yeah, and you thought that they were referring to dance.
Yeah.
Which shows the amount of, you know, gay rights movement experience you had at that time. Did that change?
To some extent. There was a period when I was very, very involved with ACT UP, but that wasn't so much gay rights as ACT UP at that point especially was really focused on AIDS. And that was, I think, what made it such a wonderful organization. Since then, I've been living abroad a lot, so I haven't had the opportunity to be involved. But I think that when you're a writer who writes openly about the experience of gay people, and when you yourself are open about being gay, necessarily you have to contend with the fact that what you're doing is political and has political implications.
Since you hadn't joined large groups before or movements before, why did you decide to join ACT UP a few years ago?
Well, it seemed impossible not to join. The situation then, as now, was so bad. There was such a clear deadlock in the government. We had Bush in the White House. We had Edward Koch as mayor of New York. We had an FDA that was not only unresponsive but completely bogged down in its own bureaucracy. And all around me in New York, people were dying. And it seemed to me, as I think it seemed to a lot of people at that point in the late 80s, that there was no alternative. Something had to be done. And ACT UP seemed incredibly exciting because its tactics were so new and they were actually so effective. A few years later, like everything, the tactics ceased to be new. They ceased to be quite so effective. I think a lot of people burnt out. I think they burnt out because, first of all, of internal battling. I remember ACT UP San Francisco ended up dividing into two different chapters based on an ideological debate within the organization. I think people also started burning out because they had the sense that for every three steps forward that you took, you were four steps back. It was a sort of endless uphill battle, and it didn't seem that we were winning. And there was a point when I think even Larry Kramer started really burning out. And I came to the conclusion, as I think a lot of people did, that perhaps ACT UP's time or its moment of glory had passed, and it was necessary to find other ways to combat the epidemic. I also had to make a personal choice to move because I was finding that I couldn't write in New York and I needed to be somewhere else. And it was at that point that I went to Spain.
Why did you go that far?
I needed to go someplace where I could hear myself think. And in New York, it was impossible for me to hear myself think. There was too much of what I call cultural noise going on. I had an invitation to go to Spain as a visiting foreign writer at a literary institute that was really a kind of arm of the Department of Culture of the Catalan government. And it seemed like too good an opportunity to pass up.
Even though you're not living in the States, you're still officially a member of the PEN, Gay and Lesbian Committee. PEN is the organization, the international organization of writers. Censorship is a big issue for the committee. Has your work ever been censored? Have you ever had a problem with that?
Just this week, I discovered that the Canadian Customs appropriated two boxes of A Place I've Never Been, my most recent book of short stories, as part of a kind of continuing campaign to keep books with gay subject matter from getting into Canada. It's a real problem, and it's something which PEN is working very hard on.
So are you planning on taking any further action?
There's not really much action I can take except to complain loudly, and I'll certainly do that.
What about in England? What's the law there about not being able to...
Clause 28.
Yeah.
Yeah, it prohibits works of art that are seen as promoting a homosexual lifestyle. England is a very odd example because the party line has so little to do with the way people actually live and think. And Clause 28 was really scary when it was introduced and when it was put into law. I think people were very worried. It's almost entirely unenforced at this point. I think the Parliament, having agreed to Clause 28, is really scared to try to use it because I think they realize that it would cause such a huge uproar. And writers, filmmakers, artists have been challenging it at every opportunity, and the government has made no effort that I'm aware of to actually enforce it.
You had a TV production of your novel, The Lost Language of Cranes. It was a joint production, I think, by PBS and the BBC.
Right.
And there was some controversy about the embrace between two males that was shown. How did you handle that? Did you try to keep out of it or what?
I thought it was a little bit overblown. There were some editing differences between the American and the English version, primarily having to do with nudity. Some scenes in the English version where the protagonists are naked were reshot for the American version with the protagonist wearing boxer shorts. Well, it seems sort of stupid for two characters to get out of bed after having made love and both be in their underwear, but I didn't think it was worth the sort of protest that a lot of people made about it, especially since what was to me the most important scene, which was the initial kiss between the characters, was preserved intact. So, you know, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but I thought it was much too much of a fuss over a fairly minor issue. The fact that Texaco withdrew its backing of Great Performances exactly at the time the Great Performances was airing both The Lost Language of Cranes and Portrait of a Marriage, I think was something much more worth yelling and screaming about.
So you're living in Italy writing a new novel now.
Yeah, I am.
What's the new novel about?
Well, it's not a novel that loans itself easily to description, and it's very much in its earliest moments, but it is pursuing a theme that has been a very important theme to me over the years, and that is, as I said earlier, the relationship between what we do and who we are.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I'm trying to talk about questions of identity in terms of gender. That is, you know, what makes a man, what makes a woman, and also what makes a writer, and to what extent does the fact that as writers we are constantly appropriating the lives of people we know and turning them into fiction, what moral consequences does that action have? These are some of the things that the novel's going to explore.
Well, David, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
David Levitt's new novel is called While England Sleeps. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what will you have on the Los Angeles fires?
Hi, Terry. Ina Jaffe reports on the fire situation today. Philip Davis on the environmental damage and the prognosis for the future there in L.A. County. I'll talk with Randy Newman about his views on the fires. Newman wrote the song I Love L.A. Richard Harris reports on the discussion about the ethics of testing for genetic diseases. And I'll talk with Danny Martin, a prisoner in California. He talks with us about his life in prison. He's been a bank robber and a drug addict, and he's written more than 50 newspaper columns for the San Francisco Chronicle.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Barbra Streisand got her start on Broadway, and that's where she became a star. So classical music critic Lord Schwartz is happy that Streisand has gone, as the title of her new album says, back to Broadway. But Lord says even when you admire Streisand the singer, you have to keep questioning her judgment. Here's his review.
Barbra Streisand is in great voice, and among the dozen show tunes she's recorded for Back to Broadway are some surprises and some of the best things she's ever done. But the selections and arrangements are so erratic, you never know if the next cut is going to be a classic or a bomb. Back to Broadway runs the current gamut of Broadway styles, from the Rubik's Cube complexity of Stephen Sondheim to Andrew Lloyd Webber at his most treacly. The two worst songs on the album are from Lloyd Webber's new musical version of Sunset Boulevard, which hasn't yet opened on Broadway. In Billy Wilder's film, Norma Desmond, the faded silent screen star played by Gloria Swanson, says that in her day, stars had faces. The problem with Lloyd Webber's songs is that they're utterly faceless. He's recycling his already generic material yet again. In Hello, Dolly, the matchmaker Dolly Levi says, "Some people paint, some sew, I meddle." Streisand's own meddling sometimes works miracles. One of the best things on the album is The Music of the Night from Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera. Streisand sings it with Michael Crawford, the original Phantom, and Streisand's old co-star in Hello, Dolly. Their interlacing voices create more intricate and interesting patterns than anything Lloyd Webber originally intended.
Floating, falling, sweet intoxication. Touch me.
Touch me.
Trust me.
Trust me.
Savor each sensation. Let the dream begin.
Some of Streisand's meddling, though, doesn't work. She overcomplicates the open-hearted romanticism of Some Enchanted Evening. She turns Kurt Weill's subtle and insinuating Speak Low into a disco disaster. In the other duet on the album, two unrelated songs from West Side Story with Johnny Mathis, her intensity overpowers his soft focus sound. The straighter she sings, the better, as in The Man I Love, or Luck Be a Lady, a song she was born for. But her unconvincing slow tempo drags down another song from Guys and Dolls, the more delicately conversational I've Never Been in Love Before. Then there's Stephen Sondheim. His verbal and rhythmic sleight of hand is right up Streisand's Schubert Alley. She actually got Sondheim to add new verses to Children Will Listen, the song from Into the Woods that she sang at Bill Clinton's inaugural party. Although it loses some of the irony it had in the original show, it has a new political bite. Streisand personalizes everything she sings, but when she sings words she really believes, the ferocity of her conviction can be overwhelming.
What do you leave to your child when you're dead? Only whatever you put in its head. Things that your mother and father had said, which were left to them too.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Barbra Streisand's new album is Back to Broadway. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Amy Sallet, with Dorothy Farabee, Nancy Greenlease, and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Someday he'll come along. Be big and strong, the man I love. And when he comes my way, I'll do my best to make him stay. He'll look at me and smile. I'll understand. And in a little while, he'll take my hand. And though it seems absurd,
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the recovery movement. We talk with Dr. Al Mooney about the rehab center he runs, which his parents founded after they sobered up. Mooney used to be the only sober member of his family. And we talk with humorist Al Franken and his alter ego, Stuart Smalley, who is addicted to 12-step programs. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.